I just want to pause for a moment to thank NTT Data, who sponsored us at Money 2020. NTT Data Services is a global business innovator, partnering with clients to simplify the modern complexities of business and technology, delivering the insight, solutions, and outcomes that matter most. Basically, they get stuff done. Learn more at nttdataservices.com.
I asked my hiring manager at the time, I said, are you sure about this? Because I haven't been in a large corporation, much less one that has 12,000 employees and operations in 130 countries. I don't have a lot of historical respect for process, organizational barriers, or any non-propulsive activity. I just won't do it.
We rightly celebrate the struggles of startups and their brave founders, but it can be tough working in a bigger company too, where powerful corporate antibodies seek and destroy new ideas that don't conform to the conventional culture. But some leaders battle the status quo inside their own companies to innovate and drive change. These are the serial entrepreneurs, and this is their story.
My name is Devin Watson. I'm the Chief Marketing Officer for Diebold Nixdorf.
So Devin, Chief Marketing Officer is a new role for you, and it's not where you've come from.
No, it was a perhaps circuitous route to this new office, but very exciting to take on this new challenge.
Well, talk about your background. What did you do before this? What's your path been?
Sure. So by accidental training, I consider myself an entrepreneur first. And I spent a number of years doing some technology consulting, but pretty quickly started to see opportunities in the marketplace that I was never going to be able to solve if I was just taking off-the-shelf solutions. So got wild and crazy, started an accidental software as a service company before that was a word.
How was that an accident?
We just saw a need to start to offer solutions that customers didn't have to install, they didn't have to maintain. Cloud wasn't a word, SaaS wasn't a word, but we thought, man, wouldn't it be great if we could just write software once and deliver it to a whole bunch of people and charge them individually?
So when was this?
This was in about 2001.
All right. So you're claiming you invented SaaS software.
No, is that what I heard? No, not at all. We just accidentally participated.
So what did the software do? What problem were you solving?
We were doing analytics at the time.
What kind of analytics?
Mainly for mid-market manufacturers so that they could get a much better handle on kind of their supply chain through to demand.
Okay.
And kind of start to break down some of the silos. A lot of the tools weren't very good back then. The visualizations weren't great. People were just doing the best they could with some of the desktop stuff. So we turned it into a hosted model, added some more eye candy so you could visualize things a bit better, but quickly figured out the hard way that, call this my accidental MBA, that it takes capital to scale a hosted business.
Right.
So I went out and started looking to raise venture capital.
Especially more so in 2001 than today.
It was the nuclear winter of venture capital. I did not know that at the time, but I was a bright-eyed entrepreneur. I met with tons of VCs. I had everyone tell me that, you know, you really ought to just sell the software on a CD. We're not sure this is a great idea, but you know, thanks for stopping in. Beat it, kid.
Uh-huh.
So I, through that process, though, learned about the venture industry, learned more about the startup ecosystem that was around me, and I made a promise to myself that the next time I had one of these conversations, I was going to be on the other side of the table no matter what happened.
So where did all this take place?
This was in Saratoga Springs, which is upstate New York. They call it the Tech Valley of New York. Actually, a pretty lively startup ecosystem. The Troy and Albany area has a lot of gaming developers, a lot of software assets, a couple companies that went pretty big like MapInfo that kind of started a nucleus around there. And there was a couple anchor venture capital funds like First Albany Tech Ventures and Primary Ventures.
So how did you stick with it? I mean, that's pretty daunting advice. And you're pretty young at the time. How old were you at that time?
I was early 20s.
Your early 20s. Yeah. You've got this idea that really hasn't taken place in the market yet, where they're used to going to a computer store or maybe ordering online and having a box with a couple of CD-ROMs shipped to them. Yep. You've got a completely different idea around that. They don't think it's a good idea, but you ended up kind of winning that battle. What was that like?
It wasn't easy. We, again, I call it my accidental MBA because we did some really smart things that I can't take credit for at the time because they just made sense to us It wasn't a robust strategy, but we went to customers and we just got really tight with them. We needed to have empathy to solve their problem. And we built good enough relationships that the customers prepaid, basically funded our R&D. So we never went without having a paying customer from day one, which was fantastic. So I didn't have to max out my credit cards to stay alive too badly. We didn't have to live lean, of course, but having the customers close, having paying customers from day one, having customers that would ride with us while we iterated and brought new stuff out, enabled us to kind of keep the lights on, get it off the ground. But we weren't able to actually make it. We eventually shut the business down and, you know, had to go look for a new role in life.
What was the proximate cause of death?
It was very difficult to reach scale. So we were able to get close to a handful of customers.
It's a common cause of death for early stage companies, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. The early customers that could keep the lights on and help us get through the R&D cycle weren't enough to turn it into a real business. They were enough to help me turn it into a real product.
Right.
But that was insufficient.
Right. So you just closed it down and
we did.
Had to walk away.
We did.
Was that hard?
It wasn't a happy day, especially, you know, with an interest payment looming on my Visa. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'd made that promise to myself that the next time around I was going to be on the other side of the table. So I spent several months in a junky apartment that I could hardly afford to keep the lights on or keep the fridge stocked. And I wrote an investment memorandum on three companies that I thought were really interesting that VCs were overlooking. I sent it to nearly every venture fund I could find, hundreds. And then I called them back to back, one after another after another. And as you know, it's a very small industry, venture capital. Everybody knows each other.
Right.
Eventually, they started passing the report around going, have you heard from this kid yet?
Yeah. And fair warning, he's going to call.
Yeah, exactly.
Again and again.
I got a call from a fund that I had pitched. And they said, hey, Devin, you know, we got your report. Why didn't you send it to us directly? I said, well, when I pitched you, you shot me down pretty brutally. They said, well, to be clear, we hated your idea, but we thought you were great. So they said, why don't you come in and, you know, let's have a talk. Came in, they hired me on the spot, and spent the next 5 years with a firm that's now called Primary Ventures, High Peaks Ventures at the time that I joined. And
Where were they based?
Based in Troy, New York, but did a lot of deals in New York City as well, but kind of focused on that near geography. And we actually had backing one of the companies that I originally wrote about, a company called AllWorks, eventually exited to Paytech.
And what did they do?
They were in the voice over IP systems for small businesses. Very cool solution. One that, as an entrepreneur, I wanted to buy but couldn't quite afford yet. So we had kind of a first really nice deal there out of that original memo, and then went on to focus a lot on software and services, and actually eventually a little bit of fintech.
What was your first fintech investment?
So I supported my managing director in a deal we did for a company called TXVIA, which amazingly is founded by one of the guys from Money 2020.
Right. So how'd that deal work out?
It worked out well. That's one that exited to Google a few years ago.
Right.
It exited after I'd left the fund. So I spent several years kind of working my way up the ranks, you know, to vice president at the fund where I could, you know, go out and source deals and lead the diligence and things like that. And along the way, I found a company in the cloud computing space, a platform as a service that was specifically geared to solve some of the challenges in software as a service, because there's a lot of plumbing that has to go under the hood of that, obviously. And really neat company called Apprenda. I worked with the management team there for quite a while, coaching along, helping them get investment ready. And then the fund I was with led the Series A in that. I worked with them for about maybe 6 more months. And then I got the wild and crazy bug again and joined that company full time out of the venture world. So I went back to doing God's honest real work.
And what did that company do?
So they're platform as a service company.
So entrepreneur turned VC, turned entrepreneur again.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then somehow you end up at Diebold, now Diebold Nixdorf.
Yeah.
And how'd that come about?
Wild and crazy transition number four, I suppose. So I spent a few years with Apprenda. I was the 11th person on the team. We've since grown to over 100 folks and counting, raised $56 million in VC. Obviously, we knew how to do that. very cool company. I helped on business development, you know, partnerships with key industry players, but also had some responsibilities for enterprise sales. So I was one of the hustlers there. And along the way, I met a company headquartered out in Ohio with global reach into the financial services industry called Diebold at the time. They were looking to kind of rethink how they were running their software business. They wanted to kind of rethink that portfolio, how broad it was, what other problems they could solve. And I met them through a sales process of all things, and then got a call a few months later, and somebody from the Midwest wanted to meet with me and see if I'd be interested in helping out with kind of a software transformation. Flew out, had dinner with a couple of the executives, got hired on the spot, and moved out a month later.
So you ended up moving to Canton, Ohio, my hometown, actually.
Absolutely.
I spent most of my childhood not very far from your current headquarters there. So did that give you a second thought that, you know, you weren't going to New York, you weren't going to Silicon Valley, you were right. going to Canton, Ohio? But obviously it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah. And so it was a neat transition for me for a couple reasons. I'd always been in small enterprises, either right. venture capital or startups,
right.
where you know everybody's first, middle, last name, where they live, what their phone number is, you know, everything, right?
Right.
It's a very different culture. It's a very different execution style. And when they were bringing me on board at Diebold, and this is 5+ years ago now, I asked my hiring manager at the time, I said, are you sure about this? Because I haven't been in a large corporation, much less one that has 12,000 employees and operations in 130 countries. I don't have a lot of historical respect for process, organizational barriers, or any non-propulsive activity. I just won't do it. And he said, no, we're hiring you intentionally to be an organizational wrecking ball, right? They wanted somebody that, you know, had that kind of entrepreneurial DNA, but also could take the portfolio view of things from a VC standpoint that was kind of attractive to them. What was attractive to me was really the space and the company. So Diebold's a 158-year-old brand, really well-respected, great roots in innovation. They've reinvented themselves multiple times over that time frame because you can't be static for 158 years and live, right? You need to reinvent yourself. You need to reinvent your product portfolio. They'd been able to do that a number of times. And that was a really cool story to be involved in as we went into the next stage of transformation, which was digital. So that attracted me to it. The other thing that was really exciting for me was the fintech opportunity. So when I looked at Diebold and now Diebold Nixdorf, it's a great place to solve really cool challenges that affect people daily. So we touch millions of people across the world. We have 2 million ATMs and point of sale systems, plus all our digital portfolio. So we're with the consumer when they're buying a birthday present. We're with the consumer when they stop at an ATM to deposit their first paycheck. We're there at a lot of really cool moments. So it's a great substrate to do innovative, cool stuff on top of.
You were brought in as an organizational wrecking ball, as you said. Were you the first such wrecking ball, or were there others?
So at the time, they were trying to build kind of a nucleus of some new innovation capability.
Right.
So myself and one of my counterparts, Richard Harris, who's head of design and new innovation right now, we were kind of the first nucleus, right? Some of the guys that weren't going to take the historical answers for givens, that were going to focus only on propulsive activity. And we formed a group, and we actually brought in a lot of additional blood to solve for certain things, right? The right DNA was there, right? Great engineering capabilities, great problem solving capabilities, but we did need to augment a few things to kind of speed things up, to be a little more transformative. So we called it our team of hackers, hustlers, and designers. You have to have all three together if you're going to be successful.
Right. And often described as the kind of entrepreneurial formula, but you were going to apply it in an intrapreneurial setting.
Exactly. Exactly. And a couple of the key things that we did that in retrospect were pretty darn smart. We intentionally brought in people that had exposure to different areas, whether that was retail, whether that was broader payments expertise, et cetera. It just gave us a broader perspective to solve problems from. The other thing that was, again, very clever in retrospect was we made a deal with the leadership team that we needed to be incredibly fast and incredibly agile and we weren't going to have a antiquated governance process slowing things down. So we basically said, look, we're going to go as fast as we can. We're going to do a lot of neat stuff. Every now and then, we're probably going to break a teacup or two. But if you don't like the results, the option is you can get rid of us, right? Or we can keep going. But we're not going to slow it down. And it was a bold move, but it was well received.
It was well received right off the bat?
It actually was by the leadership team.
Okay.
Not everybody throughout the organization was psyched about that. But the leadership team, you know, had seen us put some points on the board. We had enough credibility that they were behind it. So it actually wasn't a very long conversation to kind of just get to that model. We did still, you know, try to make sure that the organization understood what we were doing, understood the strategy behind it. And we took a very structured approach to how we innovated. We didn't just throw spaghetti at the wall and hope for the best, which I think is a symptom of some large organizations not really knowing how to solve. So what we said was we're going to have an insight-driven approach to this, a market insight founded on data, a very robust point of view on where we think things are going and why, and then let's come up with our view on where are there industry gaps that we can solve with new product, with new portfolio, new relationships, right? Even partnering is part of innovation. It's not just building stuff on your own internally. And out of that rigorous insight-led strategy, we'll then attack things using new technology, et cetera, et cetera. So we would never go at the problem from, hey, look, we've got the new XYZ technology. Let's go figure out how we can shoehorn it into something that maybe somebody might pay for.
Right.
We went looking for pain points that we thought would exist in 12 to 18 months, not the current ones, and then use the technology to fill in how you can build a solution around it. And that was actually, again, helpful in getting that permission to execute fast, was people at least understood kind of where we were charging. We weren't just saying, hey, we're going to go take some hill in some state. Right. Trust me.
Right.
Right.
We're going to take something that you currently revere and we're going to blow it up because that's what we do.
Right.
Right. Right. Nobody likes that story.
No. So we didn't make it sound like a ill-conceived or ill-planned suicide mission. We had, you know, a very, very specific point of view on where we're going and why.
What's the biggest barrier that you had to overcome?
I think for us, it was clarifying what we were doing with customers and the sales organization. And that takes a lot of communication, which can be, you know, a little bit of an overhead that you need to plan for. Reason that was a learning moment and kind of a key thing that, you know, we needed to solve was a lot of what we did was very public. And the reason is we would take our strategy, we would have a portfolio of initiatives, and we'd then try to market validate. You know, we'd treat it as a set of experiments, not as a set of internal skunk works that you're going to do in a, you know, closet and hope for the best. So we would go out and we'd partner with a customer to build something out past the prototype phase, but we'd bring them some nucleus so they could touch it, feel it, understand what we were trying to solve for and talk about. But we were very public because of that. So we'd have to talk to the customers, we'd have to bring them in, we'd have to, you know, sign co-innovation agreements, and, you know, things would end up in the press, et cetera, et cetera. And you have to have a way organizationally with dealing with the fact that a couple of these things will never see the light of day. It's going to get out there. People are going to know about it, but we're going to make the decision that we're going to give this one a kill shot. It's not going to work for whatever reason, for either technology impediments, from product market fit, from its attractiveness as a accretive margin positive solution. For any number of reasons, it might not make the cut. And if you're not used to that change and that pivot, it's very, very hard to digest the fact that you saw something and now it's gone. Right.
Did that feel like a waste then? Well, then why did we put all this time into that?
That's exactly right. Yeah. We had that conversation a million times, right? And the rebuttal is, well, we didn't put all the time and effort into that one. We put a 12th of it. Right? We had 11 other things going. 7 are working great. A few, we're not really sure. And this and another are never going to see the light of day.
So 5 years in now, are you over the hump? Do people kind of get that organizational rhythm? And are they more accepting of...
They do.
Some of those smaller failures.
Yeah, it did take a while, but now we understand how to communicate that, how to get out ahead of it, which is a big realization, and it takes a lot of the pain out of the post process.
So what'd you learn about how to communicate it and how to get ahead of it?
Well, we do a few things now. We intentionally brief every salesperson on the planet right before something goes out. Now, when you're doing brand new innovation, you got to be a little careful because you can't have things bleeding out ahead of time because you want to be able to catch your competitors off guard. You want to have those moments of surprise in the marketplace. But you need to have, you know, your internal communications very clear, very readable, one-page summary of this is what it is, this is how it's going to show up, this is where you're probably going to read about it, these are the things people might be asking you, and here's what stage it's in, right? It's an infant, or it's, you know, on the path to commercialization. Feel free to talk to your customer about it. Just orient people to what it is right now, but very concisely. Don't sugarcoat it. Make it clear and obvious internally.
So what was the first big win that you had?
It was actually the first year we came to Money 2020. We decided to kind of go big. It was our first chance to flex some of our muscles that we developed by bringing the hackers and hustlers and designers together. And we did a project that we called the Responsive Banking Concept. And in a 12-by-8-foot area, we built an entire unmanned branch that can conduct any of the transactions for the most part that you'd find in a regular branch, but it was truck transportable, drop it in place, plug it into power and Ethernet. We used an avatar on one side so that you could talk to a digital teller, but still have a human interaction, use voice guidance to conduct your transactions. We had a remote sales representative pod on the other side using cool noise canceling and directional speakers so that you feel very private. And then some really neat things with digital signage on the outside to make it pretty showy. The thing that was really cool about that project, one, we kind of put ourselves back on the map for innovation. And in the payment space, sometimes as a provider to all of the banks and financial institutions in the U.S. the way we are, at the time we didn't have as many relationships with the rest of the payments ecosystem that was starting to develop, the startups, the fintech guys, et cetera. By showing up with something really forward-leaning like that, it was an aggressive build. It really kind of put us on the map. And we also partnered with a few companies to do some customer-facing wins that we could have before the show, a couple of which were startups. And you know, they were saying nice things about, hey, this is a, you know, fortune-scale company that's actually fast and agile and not painful to work with. It was awesome. We had a great time working with the guys from Diebold. So those were kind of cool things to put in front of everybody. The great thing about the concept, though, was while it was an entire plug-and-play branch, and I didn't really expect to get orders for that, it was about 12 different products if you start to take all the jigsaw pieces apart. So we were able to run hundreds of customers through that, get their feedback on all the different things they were saying, and be able to then take the pieces out, drop some off, and then double down on the ones that worked and take those out to market looking different, but as a fully commercialized revenue generating new product. And we had a few of those wins out of that that concept platform. And that really helped the organization say, oh, now I get it. I might not see the thing that, you know, the innovation guys are showing off in the current form, but you know, 4 or 5 months later, I might have a new product that actually jumped out of that somehow.
What's a big loss that you had? And particularly one that might have been surprising to you, something you were really excited about and turned out, you know, customers didn't want it or didn't work or whatever.
So I've got a few of those from my VC days. Uh-huh. I had a company as a venture capitalist that I tried to talk my managing director into getting tattoos of their logo because I was so convinced that we were going to all be multimillionaires, and it flopped. So you just never know, right? In the innovation space, probably the area that for me has been the most challenging is in the underbanked area. And I think you see this play out with the fintechs and anybody else that's really trying to tackle that space. There's a big need. There's a altruism component to it. There's a business opportunity to be had that's good for the consumer and good for the providers. There's a big and loosely understood market. There's a few entities that really understand that marketplace, but by and large, the overall ecosystem doesn't understand it terribly well. And it's an area that I've found very, very difficult to tackle and kind of establish traction in. So I've taken a couple different stabs at that marketplace, and none of them have really worked yet. So that's kind of the one that keeps knocking me down, but I keep coming back at it.
You're still working on it.
Yeah.
In your journey from entrepreneur to VC to entrepreneur, I mean, what were some of the lessons you were able to take from your past life and apply it in your current role?
There's a few things, and I look for these in all of my hires and, you know, the people that I promote within, you know, to leadership positions. And, you know, I think there's a constant pull for a large organization to, just by a unfortunate natural de-evolution, to get bureaucratic. And there's reasons that that needs to happen in really big institutions. You know, at our current scale, we're around 5 billion and 24,000 employees in 130 countries. You need process to manage that. Otherwise, you have a horde, right? Right. You have just absolute anarchy.
12,000 ways of doing things.
Exactly. So you need a certain amount of process. You need a certain amount of lightweight bureaucracy. But when I hire people in, I'm looking for them to also be the antidote to that getting out of control. So I look for people, and I think I fit the mold as well. I hope I would hire myself. Never thought of it that way. Who are forward thinking. So they're looking to solve the problem that isn't obvious to everyone else yet. And that's a, you know, key entrepreneur skill set. More importantly, though, if you're a solo entrepreneur and you're forward thinking, you can just go execute. You don't have to explain yourself to anybody unless you need outside capital. So you can, by force of will, go after it. To be an intrapreneur, you need to be an awesome storyteller so that you can get everybody else to understand this unique insight that you have and not just say, "Nah, I don't buy it. The data doesn't support it." Well, it might not support it today because we're talking about something that doesn't exist yet. So being able to marry forward thinking with storyteller is important. The other one is, I think you need intrapreneurs that are scrappy and resourceful. Because you won't ever get all the headcount you need. You won't ever get all the budget you want. You won't ever get all the permissions that you need in order to play. So you have to have the scrappiness to kind of get after it. You have to have the resourcefulness to go around and say, "Hey, Joe, really need some help, man. I know it's not on your goal sheet and it's not in your cost center, but if we don't get this done, I'm sunk," right? You need to be able to just be able to bring people in, solve some stuff in kind of a guerrilla style. And entrepreneurs, you know, generally have that DNA. The last piece that I look for is collaboration skills. And again, can't let those become bureaucratic. So people that are mentally tuned to collaborate, but also hate non-propulsive activity, right? So they'll find the right people to help solve a problem. They'll look at the Rubik's Cube in a different way, but they won't add any more voices than necessary. They won't accidentally start committees upon committees upon committees. So that focus on only propulsive activity. So that's what I look for.
Devin Watson, thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I'm JP Nichols. This has been the Serial Entrepreneur Podcast. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star rating. That really helps other people discover it. You can also learn more and support this and all the other great podcasts from Provoke Media at provoke.fm.